Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Technological innovation is progressing at such a rapid pace these days that the lines between science fiction and science fact are starting to blur. That's apparent in the latest issue of the MIT Technology Review, which highlights 10 breakthrough technologies that will shape our world. The list includes self-driving trucks and brain implants to treat spinal cord injuries. To see the full list, visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're going to talk about two other of those breakthroughs, facial recognition and something called reinforcement learning in artificial intelligence. Joining us by phone is Senior Editor for Artificial Intelligence at MIT Technology Review, Will Knight. Welcome back, Will.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've talked about facial recognition before, but the technology is getting a real foothold in China. You recently took a trip to China. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so there are a lot of companies investing heavily in facial recognition there, and it's really a function of the fact that the technology has gotten so good and so accurate that you can recognize people. You don't have to be just standing in front of a camera still. You can be kind of just passing a camera and seen from a funny angle in odd lighting, and the technology is good enough to recognize a person really accurately. So companies are looking at this as a biometric for authentication. You can already make payments online by using your face to log in instead of a password or a fingerprint. And you know, even more conveniently, you can use it to access a lot of things. So you can Baidu, one of the big internet companies out there, has been working with one regional government to allow people to potentially buy train tickets, but to enter lots of attractions just using their face. And so it's a very, very quick way to authenticate people. And as I say, it's because this technology has just suddenly become, or in the last couple of years, become so reliable.
What are they measuring when in facial recognition?
Well, so the technology is measuring the distance between certain points on your face. So you have a system which kind of identifies these points, and then it measures the distance between those. But then this is fed into a machine learning algorithm, which is able to identify the salient points in order to match those measurements with a person. And it just turns out that you can use those measurements to really distinguish people pretty reliably. I mean, we do something similar, I suppose, but it's a pretty reliable, amazingly sort of reliable way to recognize people.
When you say we do something similar, you mean humans do something similar?
Right. So we recognize each other. But I don't know
who you're talking about anymore, Will.
Well, I don't want to overstate that, because these systems obviously work in quite a different way. But there have been some research showing that the technology that's emerging can recognize faces as well or even better than people, which is kind of astounding if you think about it.
What is it about China or Chinese culture that makes this a good candidate for kicking off this technology? Why are they embracing it?
That's a great question. I don't want to pretend to be an authority on Chinese culture or anything, but there certainly are slightly different attitudes towards privacy and technology, and there's a real sort of enthusiasm for technology there. I think maybe there would be more resistance to it if you tried to introduce this in the U.S., but we do tend to weigh convenience against objections such as privacy. People give up a lot of their privacy online for the convenience of the tools available there. But I think it's also just a part of a very, very rapid adoption of new technology there. And people have a great appetite for it, and they're pretty open to experimenting with new things.
What are some of the ways that they're using facial recognition that surprised you?
I was surprised when I visited a company called Space Plus Plus, which is a startup which is working on this stuff. I was amazed when I walked in the door. They scanned my face, and then they were able to follow me around the building, just using cameras that saw my face from a angle, or just very quickly. And I was impressed by that. I was surprised that you could track people so reliably. I suppose so. Also, it's possible to go into a coffee shop and a system will recognize your face and you can pay that way. And you can imagine, you know, you just walk into a store and you automatically get your preferred order and you don't even have to pay for it. That's a kind of amazing frictionless experience. And you can sort of see where we're heading with some of this sort of e-commerce stuff. You know, there's the Amazon store, which lets people walk in and uses computer vision to recognize what they're grabbing off the shelf in order to be able to pay that way. And you can see all these advances in computer vision adding towards some pretty kind of amazing new ways of living our lives, I guess.
So what you would be doing is sort of registering your credit card account with your face.
Yeah, so I mean, as I say, you can already do this in China. You can, with some of the payment apps and payment services there, you can use you can register your face. There's also a central database of ID cards in China, which your face can be matched against. But then you hold up the app and it looks at your face and says, okay, yes, you're the right person. You can make a payment, and so you can do a similar thing in a store. I should say that they do have a liveness test, so you can't just hold up a picture. It looks for it may ask you to do something like move your head or talk, but the technology is designed to avoid people being able to fool it with a photograph.
You also wrote about advances in artificial intelligence and how computers can learn on their own from experience. It's something called reinforcement learning. Tell us about what's going on there, and is this desirable?
I think it's definitely desirable.
Okay.
I mean, it's the latest kind of trend, or a big recent trend in machine learning. And so it's actually a technique that has been inspired by research in biology, looking at the way animals learn. So instead of having to give lots of explicit instruction to a computer, you know, tell it this is what is it, this picture, or you know, this is a picture of something else. You let it experience and experiment and then reinforce its own behavior as it gets towards a certain goal. So that's suitable for certain tasks. And people are probably aware or have heard of AlphaGo, which was the Google DeepMind computer able to play superhuman, or it was able to play one of the best Go players of all time and beat them. And it used reinforcement learning. And why that's amazing is because it's not possible to program a computer to play to that level. So not only is it possible for computers to become very smart, but they can actually exceed what we can program into them. And so, yeah, I mean, you hinted at what I think a lot of people sometimes get unnerved by the speed of advances in machine learning and artificial intelligence. But I think it's really, you know, that it's not that alarming a thing, because there are lots of tasks that we do that it's difficult to give explicit instruction. So if you want machines to be more powerful, more useful, they're going to have to learn from experience sometimes, I think.
Is this a step, though, in the march towards self-awareness?
I wouldn't want to suggest that. I think it's, in some sense, everything is maybe a march towards some very distant vision. But I think, you know, we should remember that this is still a very, very distant thing. This is still a machine, a tool that is capable of doing a explicit task. But the idea of self-awareness, consciousness, is still a very, very long, a very distant idea.
You know, you referred to AlphaGo, the program trained program training using reinforcement learning. And it defeated one of the best Go players of all time, as you mentioned. Can you tell us, some people probably haven't heard of Go and why this was such a big deal for AI?
Right. Well, so the game Go involves a large board in which you place either black or white pieces. And the goal is to surround your opponent's pieces in order to capture them. You kind of create a loop around them. So the rules are actually very simple, but playing well, playing expertly is something that you can only really develop through experience, through learning yourself. And it's hard. Expert players sometimes even find it challenging to explain why they do something. And so it's kind of extraordinary that you can have a computer learn do the same thing, in a sense, learn through through playing lots of games against a version of itself. And there was even so AlphaGo played against Lee Sedol, who is one of the greatest Go players of all time, very, very expert South Korean player, and over the course of five games was able to beat him. And in one game, in several games this happened, but in one game in particular, there was a moment where the program made a move that was very unexpected. The people watching thought it must be a mistake, or the computer had a bug or something, because it just looked so unusual and is not what a human player would recommend doing. It seemed to be giving up a lot of ground, but it turned out that the computer had figured out for itself that it could build a long-term advantage by doing that. So that stuff may be applicable in a lot of different situations. For example, people are trying to apply this to self-driving cars. So you can give cars a bunch of rules how to drive along the road, but there are lots of situations in which, you know, it's just too complicated to give it explicit rules all the time. And so you would want a car maybe to learn, perhaps in simulation, which is the way people are doing it, how to drive for themselves.
So that's how they would train the cars?
That's something that's happening, and it's kind of an emerging approach. Is you'd have the car driving in simulation, or looking at data from real roads and trying to learn for itself how to do some of these trickier kind of tasks on the road.
Is this telling us anything about how computers might learn differently from us, or is it just a matter of that they learn faster and can retain more?
That's a good question. There definitely are differences. I mean, there are sort of fundamental similarities. As I say, it was reinforcement learning is inspired by research by psychologists on animals and humans, and you know, we do learn fundamentally in through experience. But there are some very different things about AlphaGo. You know, it's able to process a huge amount of games, and indeed one of the fascinating things is that it required an absurd seeming number of games to learn. So one thing that we do that machines can't do is learn from far less, and we can also take what we've learned in one place and apply that in another area. That's actually an important difference to remember when we worry about how powerful computers are getting. There's a lot of stuff they can't do, and our ability, our sort of flexibility in learning. When you see a child able to learn what it's done one day and then apply that somewhere else, that's way beyond what any artificial intelligence can do these days.
What you mentioned self-driving cars, it makes a lot of sense. Any other aspects or any other ways that you expect this technology to emerge in our everyday lives in coming years?
Yeah, I think there are probably going to be a growing number of use cases. I know Google has been looking at it as a way to minimize the energy consumption at its data centers, and a lot of industrial robotics companies are looking at it as a way to quickly have a robot perform a task. So if you want a robot to figure out how to pick something up, maybe a new object, you don't want to spend a lot of time having somebody program in the details of how to do it. And indeed, as I guess it may not be possible, then you can have it practice overnight or a bunch of them practice and share that knowledge in order to learn how to do something.
Oh, that they, once one does it, they can just input it into another.
Right. So you can do this parallel learning. That's what a number of companies are looking at. So, you know, it might take a robot a week to do all the time experimenting, figuring out how to pick something up. But if you have seven of them working together, then maybe it just takes a day.
You know, I'm just thinking that we're talking about, you know, cyber takeover of the world right now.
I don't think you need to worry about that for the moment. These, you know, remember AlphaGo was very good at Go, but it couldn't do anything else. If you ask it to make a cup of tea or to do anything, it couldn't. And I think the pace at which this stuff is happening, and the fact that it sort of touches on something very fundamental to our sense of self, our intelligence and our capabilities, can be unnerving. But I think it's important to keep it in perspective. And there's no real risk of AI running amok for the foreseeable future. So I wouldn't worry too much.
Are you one of those irritating people? You sit and watch a good sci-fi movie and you sit and debunk the whole thing the entire time?
My wife would probably agree with that. I try not to, but yeah.
All right, Will Knight, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Will Knight, Senior Editor for AI at MIT Technology Review. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you're searching for a fact, how often do you whip out your smartphone and Google it? For years, search engines such as Google referred queries to a list of website links. In recent years, Google has provided direct answers at the top of the search results. This works fairly well for questions like, who won the Best Picture Oscar in 1990? And that's driving Miss Daisy, by the way. But for some queries, the algorithm that drives the search engine responds with inaccurate information from dubious sources. Adrienne Jeffries, an editor at The Outline, wrote about that this week. You can find a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Adrienne Jeffries joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me and talking about this.
You begin your article with an anecdote from a history class at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, of course. How did a Google search play out in that case?
That's right, yeah. So an associate professor of history, Peter Shulman, was teaching a class about how the KKK had a resurgence in the 1920s, and one of his students raised a hand and asked if Warren Harding had been a member of the KKK. Professor Shulman had not heard this particular claim before, so he said, I'll have to look into that, but I'm pretty sure it's not true. Harding supported anti-lynching legislation, so it seems unlikely. But another student pulled out their phone, Googled it, and chimed in and said, oh, yeah, actually, Harding was a member of the KKK, and so were these four other presidents. And Professor Shulman went home and investigated, and it turned out that Google was producing an incorrect answer saying there were five presidents in the KKK from a apparently random website that calls itself a leading newspaper in Nigeria but had actually cribbed the story from another website. It was all very surprising that Google had decided that this was an authoritative enough source to actually surface that answer as a quote at the top of the page when you searched for which presidents are in the Klan.
So how is the algorithm working to produce this, and can it be corrected?
Yeah, so you mentioned that a lot of Google's answers for factual questions are pretty reliable. Mm-hmm. That's because Google is using a couple different sources for these direct answers. Some direct answers are coming from a database that Google calls its knowledge graph. That's something that Google has researched and curated the sources for. So that's coming from places like Wikipedia, which is generally pretty accurate, and the CIA World Factbook. Mm. So those knowledge graph answers are generally correct. That's like, when is Easter, and some biographical search queries. Where it gets tripped up is when Google starts citing answers from pages on the web. So if a web page is determined by Google to be relevant to a search query, it's able to have something excerpted from the page and used as that direct answer. So Google's saying, if our algorithm says this page is good enough to be in the top 10 search results, it's good enough for us to take a quote directly from that page so that, in theory, the searcher doesn't need to click through. They can just see that answer read on the first page. And if they want more information, they can go through, but they don't need to click on a bunch of different links to get that answer. So basically, this is speculation because Google did not share details with me, but my impression is that people find this to be very useful, the ability to just get a straight answer out of Google rather than having to use it as kind of a research tool and go a few layers down to get what they're looking for. However, in order to produce a lot of answers like that, Google has to do it sort of algorithmically. So Google is just putting these answers out there and hoping that user behavior and user reporting will correct the bad ones.
How would that work?
So there are some user signals, like what people do when they get an answer, whether they look for another answer afterward, that can indicate whether an answer is good quality. There's also a form that you can click. Each one of these answers are called featured snippets. Says feedback at the bottom. If you click that, you can fill out a form that says, like, this answer was bad, this answer was inaccurate, and you can send Google comments And Google uses that to try to filter out bad answers.
So on a piecemeal basis, they'll go, oh, all right, well, then I'll correct that in my database. But in the larger big picture, are they interested in doing anything about the algorithm itself?
Right. So I think right now they are really hoping that all of this stuff will self-correct en masse. Like each of those individual bad answers will shake out. And I did experience this while researching the story. I found a bad answer that was about MSG. It was from a conspiracy theory website. And then I did the search again 5 days later, and it was had been replaced by a more reliable result. So the system does work, but that's still 5 days of that long answer, and possibly longer, was on the internet. And the way Google presents it, it looks like Google is telling you this is the right answer. And everybody trusts Google. Mm-hmm. In surveys, Google is trusted more than the traditional media, more than social media. People look to Google as an accurate source of information for good reason, because it's been very good up till now. And I think they are kind of making a mistake by letting all of these embarrassingly bad answers through. For now, they seem to think that it can be corrected algorithmically over time. But I'm wondering if maybe they deployed it too widely.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how Google produces those featured snippets at the top. When you ask for a fact and they give you a fact, it might not be based in reality. When do we start seeing these on the site, Adrian Jeffries?
So my best answer to this is I think it started showing up in 2014, that these featured snippets, specifically the ones that come from web pages, started to pop up like this, and since then they've been increasing fast. Google is able to, because it's just crawling web pages for these answers, able to come up with new ones pretty quickly. There are various estimates for how many queries will get a featured snippet. One estimate I saw said that 15% of queries will get them. Another estimate I saw said that up to half will get them. Google, unfortunately, didn't provide details on that.
Did they talk to you at all?
They sent a statement. I can read it to you if you like.
Sure. Must be short.
It was pretty short. So they said, the featured snippets feature is an automatic and algorithmic match to the search query, and the content comes from third-party sites. We're always working to improve our algorithms, and we welcome feedback on incorrect information, which users may share through the feedback button at the bottom right of the featured snippet. And that was it.
That's where it says, was this helpful, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. They did. They have intervened in a few cases where the featured snippet was particularly egregious and got media attention. There was one example where a Guardian reporter realized that if she asked Google, are women evil, it came up with a very offensive response, very offensive, factually inaccurate response. Over the weekend, which was actually coincidence, I had been working on the story anyway, but this particular bad featured snippet started to get attention. People asked, is Obama planning a coup? And there were a couple related queries and related snippets that basically said yes and quoted unreliable sources. In both of those instances, Google intervened and got rid of the featured snippet.
But there's a proliferation of those kind of unreliable sources on the internet.
Yeah, it's really easy to find them. When I was researching the story, I was just entering random questions and basically got to pick my favorites of the bad answers that Google was coming up with. If you sit down and tool around with this, you can find one pretty quickly.
I just might do that. But tell us what your favorites are.
One of my favorites is, if you ask Google, what is a tall white? This is a popular conspiracy theory trope. It'll give you like a very funny biological answer about where tall white aliens come from. If you ask Google what iodine smells like, it will quote from a user submitted answer to the question and answer website Quora from someone who claims that they used to run a meth lab. And if you ask Google who invented email, it will produce a notorious and notoriously litigious person who says he's invented email, but that is widely disputed.
Wow. I mean, these are pretty basic things, I think.
Yeah, I think Google really is spreading misinformation here, and, you know, it's staking its reputation its very good reputation, and I'm actually surprised that the company hasn't done something to roll this feature back, or at least like deploy it less aggressively. But it seems to be standing its ground.
Is it generating income for them, some kind of revenue stream that we might not know about? I mean, is there anything? I mean, why would they be doing it?
So people really like it. It's also a distinguishing feature for Google versus its competitors. It's very good for voice. If you have a Google Home or an Amazon Echo, you're starting to get used to asking this device direct questions and it gives you a direct answer. Like, it would be frustrating if that device just read you a list of search results. Instead, they prefer to give you just one straight answer. And voice is generally believed to be on its way to becoming the dominant way that people interact with internet-connected devices. So I think it's a long play by Google. And in the short term, Google is able to do that, whereas Amazon Echo and Siri on the iPhone are not.
Right. Siri just responds with weird little witticisms if it doesn't know the answer.
Right. Or it'll say, I'll search the web for you.
Do we know, this is off topic a little bit, but I'm curious if we know whether or not how we ask questions and how that might be changing because of, you know, asking Google, and the devices in our homes now.
Right. Well, there's always been kind of a back and forth between Google and its users. Google learns from users and tries to figure out what people mean when they type in queries. At the same time, people are getting better at figuring out, you know, they're basically training themselves on how to use Google to get the best answer. So I think there's been a cycle there, a little feedback cycle. Format that seems to be winning out now is just asking an answer or asking a question, like almost conversationally. Is usually generally a pretty good way to get where you're looking for on Google. And I think, as we have these voice connected devices and they answer us in human voices, like it'll probably unconsciously will interact with them more conversationally, like we might interact with a person.
What is your advice after investigating this for people as they query Google?
So I think I noticed this because I am a journalist and, you know, I would search Google for something that I really did want to know the answer to, like, mm-hmm. can my dog eat sushi? And I would look at the response and I would see like a source that I didn't recognize. And I would think like, is this really reliable? Do I want to feed my dog sushi based on this answer that came up from a website I don't recognize? Mm-hmm. And I would just say to everyone, to keep that in mind, Google doesn't emphasize it as much as I think it could, but it does show the source of the featured snippet. So I would definitely look at that and ask yourself if you trust that website or not. And it's probably good to look at a couple places before you decide to trust an answer.
If you're working with a device, though, will they tell you, you know, if you're talking with a device, will it tell you what the source is?
I'm actually not sure about that. I'll have to punt on that question.
Yeah.
My producer says, yes, it will.
Okay. So it'll say, okay, it'll tell you where it got it from. And then you can then say, well, what's that? And
I'm not sure it'll be able to interpret that question.
Okay.
But you might have to pull out your phone or pull out your computer.
You might have to do a little work is what you're saying.
Yeah. You got to do a little work. I mean, it's counterintuitive for Google because what they want to do is take all the work out of it. But actually, they're just, I really think this is something that Google should address.
So it's like the factual questions, the can I feed my dog sushi kind of things versus who's the king of England?
So it's factual stuff, and Google also seems to be deploying these answers for like what you might say are sort of
subjective
answers. Uh-huh. So you can ask Google, like, is God real? And Google will attempt to give you an answer to that. You can ask Google how to get a date. and Google will give you step-by-step advice on how to get a date, sourced from the website WikiHow, which is another one of these contributor-driven, not expert. I mean, it's not a bad answer, how to get a date. It says, like, you know, don't use pickup lines, have good hygiene. It seems directed to men, for one thing. but it's like, why would you, you know, that just like, that question does not have a universal answer. Mm-hmm. It's an individual situation, individual mm-hmm. people involved. So it's kind of funny that Google thinks it should be the authority on that kind of thing, or that it should be pointing to somebody as the authority on that kind of thing.
Oh, gosh, if you didn't laugh. Adrian Jeffries, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me.
Adrian Jeffries is an editor at The Outline. We'll have a link to her article about Google's featured snippets and what you can and cannot trust in them on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nintendo's newest gaming console is finally out and field-tested reviews are rolling in. The Nintendo Switch has a unique design that has a place both in the living room and on the go as a mobile gaming device. And its controller, called Joy-Con, is split in two, half for the left hand and half for the right. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
All right. So the overall design of Nintendo Switch, how do you describe it and how do you think it's working?
It's a weird little tablet with controllers on either side that you can put inside of a different box that connects to your television.
The Joy-Con controllers are one in each hand. Is there a learning curve in playing a game that way? I would imagine some people aren't that good at it.
No, it's surprisingly comfortable because when you're holding the individual parts, it's really the same basic feel as when you're holding a normal controller. It's really just a normal controller split in half. It looks a little odd. Like you look down and kind of visually it seems a little strange, but when you are actually holding it and playing it, it is incredibly comfortable, you know, both on the sides of the controller or just separate from the controller down at your sides, which really caught me by surprise, you know, to not even need to look at the controllers and feel pretty comfortable. I found more than just myself, you know, people who don't even, you know, play these kinds of games particularly often have had a lot of success just being comfortable using it.
The controllers are pretty small though, right?
These are, you know, this is definitely a smaller set of controllers. They're designed to feel a lot more complete when they're connected to the tablet itself. And when they aren't connected to the tablet itself, you can either hold one in each hand or you can slide them into what is called a grip dock, which is a special thing that Nintendo made to make it feel more like a standard controller if you're really having trouble with it being kind of small.
That's interesting. What else about the Nintendo Switch are the graphics is up to standards of other gaming systems?
No, this is not designed to compete with the Xbox One or the PlayStation 4. Both of those consoles are going to deliver higher quality graphics, more realistic things. Nintendo has always been, they've always felt kind of one generation behind Xbox and PlayStation, but their focus has always been, on a really entertaining experience and you know, very family focused and being able to play as a group. And in that respect, they've continued to do a really good job with these with this console. It's, you know, designed to have multiple people in the same room play at the same time and have it be, you know, very kind of fun and engaging. And when there are, you know, kind of the single player sit down gaming sessions, while a lot of the games end up having kind of a more animated look to them, they're still very nicely designed and very compelling to play.
The first game released is The Legend of Zelda: Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, so this is the latest in kind of the Legend of Zelda series. It gets, you know, kind of a new story every couple of years from Nintendo with, you know, the same basic characters with a lot of kind of the details rearranged. Mm-hmm. And so there, you know, there are people who have played every Legend of Zelda game and they go in to play this game and have had just an incredible time playing. as far as, you know, kind of feeling like a very classic Zelda game with very modern graphics. And then there are people who have never played a Zelda game before in their life who can sit down and feel like this is, you know, kind of an open world adventure that is very similar to, you know, other modern games like Horizon Zero Dawn and things like that, where, you know, where it's just, you know, you kind of walk out into this open fantasy world and choose what you're going to do next.
Okay, for the uninitiated, who's Zelda?
Zelda is a princess of the Kingdom of Hyrule, and the main character is strangely not Zelda. It's actually someone named Link, and it's kind of funny to see people get those confused every once in a while. But it is the legend of this other person played by you.
Oh, and when you talk about those different reactions, you're saying somebody who's never played it before can enjoy it as well as somebody who's played every Zelda game ever.
Absolutely. This does not require having played previous Legend of Zelda games of any kind. You can sit down and be very familiar in just a couple minutes with how the game is played. And the story that you're playing is not interconnected with other Legend of Zelda games. So you're not missing anything by jumping into the story without having done any kind of research or anything before.
Well, that's interesting to Legend of Zelda devotees.
No, so this is, you know, it's the kind of thing, the way that this story has been designed for, you know, for a long time, each one of these games is kind of standalone. It's not like one is a sequel to the other.
Oh, okay, all right. It's always been like that then.
Right.
Okay. And what other games can users expect in the near future? Anything?
There are a ton of games coming out in the near future. They're going to re-release the Mario Kart game that was so incredibly popular on the Nintendo Wii U, mm-hmm. Called Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. There's going to be a new Splatoon game, which is these little characters with paintball guns, basically, that run around and cause some trouble. It's been very popular in the past. And there are games like Skyrim and several other Mario games that are going to be coming to the console all within the next couple of months.
All right. You sound pretty positive about this. How much does it cost?
This is $300 for everything that you need to start playing the game, including, you know, connecting it to the television and, you know, the extra controller that you go and play. And the fascinating thing about the Joy-Con, this is something that has never really been done with another console, is that it allows for two-player gameplay as well. So you actually have everything in the box for two people to sit down and play without having to need to go and buy an extra controller for a second player.
It has two Joy-Cons then.
It has a single Joy-Con, but they can be split in half and be used as individual controllers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, $300, that's not bad. You think it's going to be a hit for Nintendo, though?
I think it has already been a hit for Nintendo. According to the sales research that was released over the launch weekend, this is actually the most successful launch that Nintendo has ever had for a single game console, and The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild is already the most popular launch title that Nintendo has ever had.
Wow.
So it has already been incredibly popular, and as a consequence, it is really hard to get right now.
Okay. Put in your order and wait, right?
That's right, yeah. Check back with your local store as frequently as you can.
A new ultra-small laptop is set to be released this year. Tell us about the GPD Pocket. Is it like a phone or what?
No, so we used to call these things netbooks. You know, probably 10 years ago, where there was, you know, just kind of smaller, underpowered machines that were almost pocket sized. They were so small. And so this is kind of a return to that form, I guess, to see how popular it is now. It's called the GPD Pocket, and it is, 7 inches across, so really just not much bigger than your average smartphone. But it has, when you open it, a surprisingly full keyboard that you can use to touch, and it runs a full version of Windows on it.
Is it a keyboard with buttons or a touch keyboard?
No, this is a keyboard with buttons. This is when you open it up there, they don't have a lot of travel to them, so they're very thin keys, and you're not going to really feel much of a button press when you press them in. But there, you know, you have access to a relatively full keyboard and a nice kind of touchpad to interact with things, and it has the potential to be a very portable laptop for someone who doesn't need a lot of power.
What do you compare this to with what's already out there?
I guess the closest thing to compare this to would be a lot of the sub $400 to $500 tablets that are running Windows right now. You usually see them with 8 or 10 inch screens, and keyboards can often be purchased extra to attach to them. Is probably the closest thing that I would say to this.
And I guess it's starting to, tell us about the company that's launching this device.
So GPD is not a particularly well-known company. This is actually a crowdsourced project. This is something that you're going to be ordering through Indiegogo if you're interested. But the company has produced prototypes already. They're the parts that they're using, are all. It's not like a stretch that this is going to exist in the future. So it's really just kind of a new thing from a relatively unheard of company.
I know that their pitch is that everybody needs one of these things, but who are you envisioning it for?
This is going back to people who mobility is, kind of the most important thing, where, not having a 5-pound laptop on your back is something that you find incredibly valuable. And they're going to run, for $400, if this is able to run, one or two apps without, slowing down or running into problems like that, I think it's going to deliver on that promise pretty well.
And therein lies the comparison to say, just why not just get a small keyboard that works with your smartphone is because of what it can manage.
Right. This is going to be able to offer a little more. The screen is going to be not much bigger, but a little bit bigger. It's going to, it's going to have, kind of that full Windows experience, which is still valuable to a number of people.
Does it have any bells and whistles on it of note?
Not really. It's, this is a very slim, very, lightweight. This is the feature here is that it basically fits in the palm of your hand, or that you could slide it into your back pocket. But please don't put your laptop in your back pocket.
Tech company LG is releasing its latest flagship phone, the G6. The G6. So what about LG in general and how it stacks up?
LG had a lot of problems last year with the predecessor to this phone called the G5. They were trying really hard to deliver kind of a modular experience where you could remove the bottom of the phone and attach, a larger battery or, a speaker or a camera grip, and it seemed like a really kind of clever idea if LG could keep that momentum and keep releasing things that were useful for it. But it turned out that they were unsuccessful when it came to that. So they've actually completely redesigned their phone, and they've done something unlike any other phone that they've released before. The LG G6 is made of metal and glass instead of various forms of plastic like we've seen in the past. It actually has glass on the front and back, similar to Samsung's Galaxy S line, so wireless charging can happen on the phone just by setting it on a dock. And the phone has an unusually tall screen compared to what you would see in most phones right now. It actually has a screen that is a 2-to-1 aspect ratio, so it's twice as tall as it is wide. And it's really kind of interesting that when you hold the phone, it feels thinner than you feel like it should be, but it also takes a little more reach to get to the notification bar at the top of your phone now.
Well, wait, I mean, you said it's twice as tall as it is long. That's not typical.
Twice as tall as it is wide. No, usually what you see what you see is usually something called a 16:9 or something a little further back, where the phone is still rectangular, but it's usually a little thicker on the sides than what you would get from this phone.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. And camera, battery life, that sort of thing, how's that working?
So LG has put an incredible camera in this thing. Our tests so far show that it's entirely likely to be one of the best cameras that we've seen so far this year. And we are still kind of early, but it's still really good for LG to come out, with a very powerful camera. The battery on it seems very capable compared to what we had seen previously. It's going to easily get you through a full day. It comes in a couple of fairly generic colors, for silver, black, and gold. But it's this very shiny glass on both sides, so you're probably going to put it in a case almost immediately so that you don't damage it, which is another thing that we've seen frequently with phones recently.
Some of the features available on the phone might be different depending on what country you live in. Why is that? What and why?
Well, LG has done this before, where there's different regions that they work with have different features. In the past, there was a feature called No TV that would be only available in Korea because Korea had an over-the-air television service that could be accessed through a simple antenna in the phone. But the U.S. and the U.K. had never ever used anything like that, so there was no reason to put that technology in the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see similar things to that here, where LG's being a Korean company, they have features that only really apply to that country.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day, and Amazon Alexa has something special planned. What's going on?
Yeah, this is really interesting. Amazon is always kind of tacking on new features to the Alexa service. And starting tomorrow, there's actually a service that's already active. You can actually activate it now, but it'll give you a notification about it tomorrow, where you can ask Alexa who inspires her, focusing on Alexa being, kind of a very female voice. And you will get a response with one of, I think, 13 different prominent women from history and a little bit of detail about what makes them exceptional.
That's kind of interesting. Like who?
There is, very modern responses like Serena Williams, Ada Lovelace. There's just a ton of different options. And the core to this feature is really kind of an invitation to install the skill that will give you way more information. What you'll hear here is basically one or two sentences from Alexa about, Jane Goodall or Marie Curie. But you can install the Inspirational Women skill, and it'll give you a ton more information when you ask about Hedy Lamarr or Mary Jackson, or really just a ton of other women.
Interesting. All right. And then real quickly, you recently wrote about Yelp helping find bathrooms for people who are transgender. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is actually the second app to offer this service. Google Maps was the first. And so now it, as part of Yelp's search criteria, which has, has always had just a massive list of things that you could check that will, kind of filter restaurant results near you a little better. You'll be able to search for gender-neutral restrooms, in restaurants that are in your area.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, Russell Halley, thanks so much for joining us today, as usual.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Russell Halley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia LaNat, AllSides interns Sarah Stacey, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Be sure to like AllSides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU AllSides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This has been Tech Tuesday on AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.